Good morning. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fifth Division, the Honorable Justice Raymond W. Mitchell presiding, case number 22-1787, consolidated with 22-1790, Mertes versus Village of Mount Prospect, Village of Mount Prospect versus Mertes.
Hey, good morning, folks. I'm in receipt of your motion to clarify, which, of course, we granted yesterday, and we appreciate you reaching a consensus on how best to proceed. So we'll start with Mertes versus Village of Mount Prospect. It's our practice to allow 20 minutes aside with 5 minutes rebuttal. You know, of course, I imagine in the first case, we'll probably go a little bit longer. And in the second case, because we'll be covering at least some of the same grounds, perhaps we will we'll be more timely. So with that, we'll begin, Mr. Duda.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. My name is Thomas Duda. I represent the plaintiffs in this case. May it please the court. The issue in this case is that Eric Mertes was found by a hearing officer to be eligible for placebo benefits as a result of a series of doctors phrased, and I know it's another case. It's the straw that broke the camel's back. But in any event, Eric Mertes was granted on March 18, 2014. He was granted a line of duty disability pension as a result of these catastrophic injuries. There is a dispute in the next case as to whether or not these catastrophic injuries were the result of his pursuing what he reasonably believed to be an emergency. The hearing officer found he was catastrophically injured. He found that these were the result of what he reasonably believed to be responding to an emergency. And he found that Mertes was eligible for line of duty disability. But his award provided no relief in terms of actual premium payments based on the fact that approximately a month after the grant of line of duty disability benefits, Mertes, as a result of a letter from the village, okay, because the village wrote him a letter saying, we're not paying your premiums anymore, you got to do something. And what he did is they went on his wife's plan because his wife's employer paid 80% of the premium. So the hearing officer found not only that the use of the wife's plan disqualified Mertes from receiving any monetary relief under placebo, he found that its simple availability disqualified him. And the defendant takes that position. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time arguing as to the circumstances as to why he took a policy that he paid $400 a month for rather than giving the village $1,600 a month at a point in time that he had lost his job. The authority on this case starts with the case Pyle versus Granite City.
Just before we get into the merits of it, just so we're clear, and I think this is certainly implied by what you said, but basically in the second half of the hearing officer's ruling, he took away any benefit, any value to your client from the first part of the ruling. It kind of doesn't matter if he was qualified, if he was eligible, if he should have gotten them, because in the end, he doesn't get any relief for that eligibility. Is that accurate?
It's accurate, but the way I would phrase it he found him eligible, but he but you're eligible for PSEBA, but you don't get any. You
right.
don't get any money. You're eligible, but you get zero.
Right.
Okay.
In perpetuity, you're never going to get anything. Doesn't matter. That's basically the rule.
Well, that's really unclear. The defendant would like to believe that, but the circuit court judge, although it's not in his order, in his in listening to argument, the circuit court judge raised the issue with the defendant. Can MetLife may decide, well, of course, MetLife, it would be unlikely they don't offer insurance.
Right.
And they could get divorced. So that circumstance could change. And the hearing officer didn't address that, but it would be my position that the village would have to put him back on the village's plan.
So the part that's clear is he doesn't get any back payment for anything he's paid. That part is clear.
Which gets me right into the Pyle case. Okay, Pyle versus Granite City was my case. And Jim Pyle had a really catastrophic injury fighting a fire. There was a backdraft, and the city never put him on their insurance plan. I will concede that Jim paid the premium on the Granite City plan from the date they stopped paying up through the date of oral argument in the case. And the circuit court ordered the payment by the city, a reimbursement of all past due premiums and future premiums. And the important thing that I need to point out to the court is that the insurance policy that Jim paid into was the same policy from the date that he was disabled through the date of oral argument. It was the same carrier, the same paperwork. I mean, he didn't even get a new insurance card. And the circuit court, as I said, ordered payment of all premiums. The appellate court's decision ultimately affirmed that portion of the opinion that reimbursed his out of pocket until he reached age 65. Okay. When he reached age 65, the court said, well, you're now Medicare eligible. And there are four paragraphs in the opinion, the two that most closely, in my opinion, are the holding in the case. Once you're 65 and you become Medicare eligible, whatever insurance that is covering you becomes secondary. And I'm sure the court's familiar with that because you must have spent 15 pages analyzing whether or not the policy was secondary or primary in the McCaffrey case. That was a huge issue in McCaffrey, the federal regulations that said if you're receiving Medicare, that's your primary carrier. So
yeah.
The policy didn't change. What changed was the characterization of the benefit under that policy. And the premium that Jim had been paying didn't change. It was the same premium month after month after month, up through oral argument. But because of the Medicare regulation, and I don't think it's in the statute, I do think it's in the Code of Federal Regulations, the insurance policy that Granite City was carrying and Jim was paying became supplemental. And of course, everybody knows that 10A of the PSEBA statute excludes supplemental benefits from its coverage expressly. It specifically says that basic group health insurance does not include supplemental benefits. So once the federal was now a supplemental policy, the city of Granite City's obligation ended, but they paid everything up to that point. Now, the cases since then have failed to emphasize the language that I emphasize. But it's in there. I quoted it for the court. I know you're not supposed to do, they have extensive quotations, but I really wanted the court to have the ability to read the statute. And
so let me understand what you're saying. You're saying that the reason that pile and that line of cases has to be limited to Medicare is because of that language about supplemental benefits is
That's true, and it's true in Pyle. I'm not sure. I think McCaffrey and Barry went beyond that. McCaffrey and Barry, in fact, McCaffrey expressly states it. If insurance is available to you, if insurance is available to you, it reduces the obligation of the municipality to zero. They did understand, clearly understood how the introduction of Medicare alters the nature of the village's availability, but they took it a step further, and they took it in a step that really profoundly affects the benefits. So the next thing point I want to make, and I'm not sure who was on the panel in Barry, but Barry kind of in a snarky manner.
We're on the panel in there.
There was Barry had a brilliant trial judge.
Yes, Doug Mitchell was the trial judge in there.
contrary to what the snarky comment made by the appellate court, that there's nowhere in the statute that placebo is a lifetime benefit. Pyle started out that was a holding in Pyle, and I quoted it for the court that it is a lifetime benefit, which is somewhat inconsistent, by the way, with their ultimate cutting off his benefit at age 65. But federal law kind of required that they do that.
Well, I'm a little confused by your concession or that supplemental benefits includes Medicare supplement, because as I read that, one way to read that language is that group health is covered, but we're not talking about vision, we're not talking about dental, we're not talking about these other benefits, we're talking about group health, period. And I think Medicare supplement is a group health plan, maybe a supplemental group health plan, but certainly group health. I just ask you if you think it necessarily has to encompass.
No, and not necessarily, but I'm reluctant to I will assert that now that the court mentioned it, but I'm coming from in my opinion, I'm coming from behind in this case, so I don't want to overstretch my luck. But the important thing is that the way this operates is really deleterious, because what I don't concede is that 10A1 applies if the firefighter has to pay the premium or any part of the premium.
What does 10A1 mean in your?
It's a modification. 10A1 means that in the event that other insurance is payable to the beneficiary, it reduces the employer's obligation. And
give me an example.
MetLife has been in the life of the Murdys during his entire career with the Village of Mount Prospect. And they do provide group insurance for their employees, but they only pay approximately 80% of the premium. So for the employees at MetLife to carry it, they have to kick in the other. The premium for the Village of Mount Prospect during the employment and during the time, and they do owe him the money from March 18th through April 14th, 2014, that during that time they were paying $1,666. So the way that 10A1 was intended to operate is that when insurance like MetLife comes along, the employer can force the employee to their obligation by $1,200. It reduces their obligation, but it doesn't eliminate their obligation. Okay. And this case, I think, is a classic example of how the General Assembly envisioned this proviso as being operational. If the employee has to pay the premium, or let me back up, the word payable to the okay, I've got to look the language up. Let me get the exact words. Yes. Health insurance benefits payable from any other source shall reduce the benefits payable under this section.
Right. So the
reduction, in my opinion, the word, I'm sorry, did I don't mean to interrupt.
No, it's inevitable on Zoom, but the reduction contemplated in 10A1 is it's a reduction not in the premium, but in the benefits payable, right? I guess a bigger picture question I have is
I don't agree with that. I think the word benefits means the placebo benefit, not the insurance benefit.
Okay. So is it your position that the availability of other insurance, whether or not the claimant has ever made use of that, but just the mere availability of other insurance, that becomes a limitation on the obligation created under 10A?
That's what Barry says.
Well,
Barry says, Barry and McCaffrey. In McCaffrey, the police officers.
You asked us to depart from those cases.
Yes, that's true. No, I'm asking you to follow Pyle and not McCaffrey and Barry. I understand. Because I think ultimately the Supreme Court of Illinois has never decided this issue at all. And the reason my briefs are so long is in the event that I'm not successful for the Murdys, I'd like invite the Supreme Court to visit this issue. But the important thing, Your Honor, to understand is that if 10A1 does not contemplate that the employer maintains its financial obligation to pay for the insurance, then it's really the statute is meaningless, because I now have a case wending its way through the system where a firefighter had a concurrent employment business, and as part of the business, he employed his stepson, and he bought health insurance. He bought on the open market. You know, at any point in time, you can go out and buy insurance for yourself. I mean, it's there. So he bought insurance for his stepson. Nobody else in his organization. And the employer's taking the position, if he could buy insurance for his stepson, he could buy insurance for himself. And if he could buy insurance for himself, then there are health insurance benefits that are payable from another source, and he's disqualified. And as I point out to this court, in 2010, with the enactment of the ACA, I envision a municipality when a firefighter is catastrophically injured while responding to an emergency, the employer saying, "You're qualified for PSEBA. Here's the website for the ACA. Get yourself a policy," because the ACA is an insurance benefit payable from another source.
Yeah.
And if the firefighter can be forced to pay the premium, they're in the park.
But I understand that argument, but what I'm confused about is your interpretation of 10A1, and we'll go back to this case. Let's say Mr. Murdy's wife's policy was far less generous than the fire department's policy. He'd still have to take that $400 policy What if it didn't have anywhere nearly the same benefits? What are you saying? Because there's
unfortunately, Your Honor, I as much as my heart is with saying that they could turn it down, if you read that Peoria case where the city of Peoria changed their insurance policy and designated their high deductible to be the official placebo policy, I think if that's the law, they could insist that even if MetLife's policy was a substandard policy, that they accept it. But the question is, would they have to pay the premium? And in my opinion, the whole purpose of the placebo statute is to relieve firefighters of the economic burden of carrying health insurance, because
good coverage. By definition, they are people who, generally speaking, need good coverage because they have health issues and injuries that are going to, for most of them, be with them for the rest of their lives.
Well, the CAGFA report that I cited in my brief makes that point. And
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that report, which we looked at, says that about a third, 25% of the people who are getting these also have other coverage. So are
yes.
they ignoring the law? What's going on?
No, I, Your Honor, that's why I quoted in my brief. CAGFA obviously is reporting that there are firefighters who took the other coverage, which reduced their employer's obligation, but somehow they did it in tandem with their employer's policy, which brings me to the issue raised in McCaffrey quite strongly, and both the defendant and myself quoted from the court, that the language in 10A1 is so succinct that the court felt that they didn't get sufficient direction in how to implement it. I think the General Assembly could present themselves to a municipal employer were varied and different. It didn't have to be that hospitalization benefits were available through a traditional policy. And the basis that would protect the firefighters' rights under PSEBA, and at the same time reduce the obligation of the municipality. And that's why there's not three pages of how one accomplishes that goal. I think the General Assembly contemplated on a case by case basis. The second
Mr.
point,
Duda.
Yes.
Mr. Duda.
The legislative intention was to provide coverage for firefighters or first responders
and
for
families.
Their health insurance until they receive the Medicare, because if the Medicare, then that's when they want to cut it off, because then the government as opposed to the municipality. Is that where we are?
That's where the Fifth District Appellate Court is in Pyle. From Tom Duda's point of view, it was the General Assembly's intention that if a firefighter were killed, duty, that health insurance would be available to his
children.
Spouse for her life.
Yes.
And it would be if he were catastrophically injured, the firefighter would be covered for life. And oddly enough, Pyle says they are covered for life. But there's no question. Insurance becomes supplemental. And then, of course, the question is the term supplemental under the regulations of Medicare the same as the intention of the General Assembly to say supplemental in Section 10A1 of the 10A of the statute? Make in terms of.
I'm sorry, I have one quick question. You may know this, you may not, but are most of these municipalities self-insured, or is it mostly coverage they go and buy in the open market?
For health insurance, most of them carry insurance. Public risk fund, et cetera. But for health insurance, they generally they buy arm's length insurance, and most of the municipalities I deal with, and I deal with a lot of them, carry Blue Cross.
Could your client be reinstated to this plan that he hasn't been on for years? Is that something they could make Blue Cross do, put him back on the plan? Is that even something doable?
Usually, in health insurance has a open period where they take on new clients. Okay, it's a limited period of time. Whether there would be a way of avoiding that, I don't know.
But probably during open enrollment, at least they could just put him back on as a new person, basically.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That was helpful. I keep making your point.
But the second point I wanted to make in terms of the paucity of content in 10A1 is many terms in this particular statute have been completely undefined. All right. So in McCaffrey, when the court says we really can't do anything now, there's not enough direction. We send this. We recommend the General Assembly take another look at it. I think the court in McCaffrey was ignoring the reality that at least three issues came up where the Illinois Supreme Court completely gave content. And that would be Croy, where they defined what the term catastrophic injury meant. Novak, where they established the effective date that the employer becomes obligated to pay premiums, which is March 18th, 2014. And Gaffney. I mean, Gaffney gave content to what is what's reasonably perceived to be an emergency. So the Illinois Supreme Court has not shied away from giving content to Section 10 by virtue of the succinctness of the General Assembly's drafting. And I would encourage the court to do that. And I outlined in my brief, probably too extensively, the basic rules of statutory construction, in which I think it's very clear what the intent of the General Assembly is, which is firefighters and police officers are in dangerous situations, which lead, their families. That's the intent. And I cited three cases where if there's some clause in the statute that would tend to make that intent to defeat the intent, that the court can disregard those things. Pyle is understandable given federal law, but I think that McCaffrey and Barrier are wrong.
I want looking for another understanding of 10A1, because first of all, it does use the word benefits. It does not use the word coverage. So I think it's talking about health insurance, or one understanding could be it's talking about health insurance benefits. What about What do you think of how this suggestion that what it means is that if somebody, say the child or the spouse, or put in place for whatever reason, and that the placebo coverage is secondary. So there's benefits, you get benefits under your wife's coverage, and then the placebo coverage is secondary to that. Because that's usually what this phrase means when it's in an insurance policy. It means we're secondary. Your benefits are primary, we're secondary. Could it mean that? Or why couldn't it mean that?
Well, it could. I didn't argue that in my brief, but I would point out if the word benefits refers to the underlying benefit, in my opinion, that changes my whole view of the word payable. Okay. Because payable then would contemplate that it would be payable by some other source, not by the firefighter. Right. So if in this instance, if the policy with MetLife was substandard, but Kendra still had to make a $400 contribution, it would not be a health insurance benefit payable from another source because she has to pay the premium. But I must concede to the court, I construed the word benefits to mean premium. So, but that's...
It might. Okay.
Well, with the...
Well, Your Honor, I'm at the conclusion of my argument, and my summary is simply that the direction that the appellate court, the fundamental issue of what happened there, and it led to a result that could really effectively repeal the statute and the benefit, because it's particularly in the environment we operate in now. I mean, you can't open a newspaper without seeing some ad about, I think it's healthcare.gov is the Illinois navigator for the ACA. So the interpretation with the email address on it and say, get yourself some insurance because we aren't paying. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it. And thank you very much for having this by video. I appreciate that as well.
Very good. That's a tricky one. So nice job. Good morning, justices, and may it please the court. My name is Anne Skrodsky, and I represent the Village of Mount Prospect. I'm joined here in the room by Jason Geisinger. We are both of Kleinthorpe and Jenkins on behalf of the village. And just a little introductory note, I will continue Mr. Duda's two cases that both advanced to refer to the parties as plaintiff or defendant or appellant or appellee because of the two cases. So generally we've been referring to the parties just by name, claimant or Mertz, and then the village. So I'll continue to do that. I want to begin my argument by actually picking up what Justice Mikva, you and Ms. Act and how can we determine what a benefit is. Pyle has an interesting interpretation, and I'll reference a paragraph of that case. It's in paragraph 27 of the Pyle case. It talks about the fact that the benefits payable to Pyle, that being the premium of his health insurance, were reduced to zero because Pyle was the only person who was receiving a benefit under placebo. But the benefits actually were kind of a larger overall referral to any any coverage and or payment that would have been received under PSEBA. And so if Pyle had had a spouse, for example, who did not reach Medicare age and had not become eligible for Medicare coverage, she would have been continued and the city would have continued to be obligated to pay her premiums under the benefits concept outlined in the act. So it's a little bit broader than just the concept of paying a premium or paying for coverage, but it's the idea of the benefit to the firefighter extending to potentially his family and then children if applicable. So that would be the broad concept of benefits receivable under the act. And again,
you're basically saying the same thing Mr. Duda said, at least initially, which is that benefits is the benefits you're given under the act, which is coverage. The benefit is coverage.
Yes. Well, coverage. Yes. So we agree on that point. And in fact, I think Mr. Duda has kind of outlined and done a little bit of my heavy lifting. So I'm not going to belabor the point, but I just wanted to point out that there was sort of an analysis of that idea of what is the benefit, how far does the benefit go, and then what is of the Pyle case. So then kind of resetting.
Okay. If the reduction is coverage, what do you believe how do you reduce the coverage? So when they reach that point that reduction is required, are they reducing one of the policy coverage items, or is it just that it's a reduction in payment of the premium?
Well, as argued in my brief and has already referred to by Mr. Duda, our position is that the reduction of coverage simply has to be to zero. And this is the position that was taken by the McCaffrey case. The McCaffrey case said, okay, so it says that availability of secondary source health insurance reduces the village's obligation, but there's no way to calculate what the set off is, because that's totally dependent on an interpretation of, well, do the benefits have to be comparable? Does the plan offered by the village have to be comparable to the plan available in the secondary coverage? If the secondary group coverage is a higher level, let's say it's a gold plan or a silver plan, is, you know, kind of analyzed under the ACA, does the village only have to pay for the village's basic plan or the village's available plans, or are they obligated to pay for choices in coverage that the claimant is making? So there's really no way to calculate what a fair benefit or a fair set off or a monetary value of 10-1A is. And so that's what
you basically say, we can't figure out how to reduce it.
McCaffrey case spent paragraphs and paragraphs trying to answer these questions and saying that there just isn't the guidance. And I wanted to point out, and Mr. Duda actually kind of makes my point for me, that the McCaffrey case was decided in 2021. PSEBA has been revised and updated by the General Assembly in the past year, and they chose not to give any more guidance.
They didn't pay any attention to what the appellate court has done, as they often do.
Well, that's true. I would agree with you, Justice McFadden. I think that is partially true. But what I would point out, that the amendment that they did make to PSEBA in the past year is in response to the appellate court's interpretation. The appellate court.
How do you figure that?
Yeah, so the appellate court had found that in Pyle and in the Peoria case, that the city only had a city or municipality only had to allow the claimant to be on the basic plan. Right, that was the case law, that a municipality only had to cover a PSEBA claimant on whatever the village's designated basic plan was. So the amendment to PSEBA that came up forward in the past year adds the phrase, an individual whose entire premium is paid in accordance with this section shall be offered by the employer the choice of any health insurance plan available to currently employed full-time law enforcement, correctional or correctional probation officers or firefighters. So that's a direct interplay of the state of the case law saying, well, you only have to provide the basic plan, to then the General Assembly amending PSEBA. And the General Assembly did not amend PSEBA to indicate that there was any more further guidance on set-offs or any other interpretation of 10A1.
I have so many questions. Sorry. I'm going to start with the most basic one, which is, what is your response to Mr. Duda's argument that the way you're reading 10A1, it completely eliminates all the benefit of 10A? Because everybody can get insurance somewhere.
Okay, so the elimination of the benefits is a narrow reading of it, because again, I will point out in the Pyle case, in the Pyle case, the financial benefit or the coverage for Pyle himself was reduced to zero. And the same argument was made, isn't this an elimination of the benefit? And the court said, no, it's not an elimination, because first of all, if he had had a dependent, if he had had a wife or a child, that dependent would have been covered. So that doesn't necessarily.
Who has coverage available, no matter how much it costs, has to go on that coverage and they lose their benefits under the statute. That's your argument. That really is. Or if there's a limitation to your argument, I'd like to understand what it is. I understand what it is in Pyle, because in Pyle it was limited to Medicare eligibility. But you're saying no, far beyond Medicare eligibility for any insurance. So explain to me where the limitation is or why it doesn't eliminate under your.
Sure. The limitation would be if the claimant didn't have secondary source. Could go, he has been. So if, assuming that the hearing officer's order is not disturbed in any other way, assuming that the hearing officer's finding that the claimant is eligible for PSEBA stands, then if his wife, again, if she loses her job, he's the village has got to cover him.
Okay.
I mean,
coverage you can go out and buy on the open market. It's got to be coverage that your spouse has or you have from another job. That's the limitation on your interpretation.
Right, because I would argue that's the word available. The word is that the benefit has, under 10-1A, he has to have the benefit payable from any other source.
So it's got to be a source that's already in place that his wife has, or he has, or his child has, somebody has, that he can get coverage on. It doesn't have to go out and buy. That's the limitation.
Right. Benefits payable from another source. Yes. That's how I would interpret that language. I don't, for my purposes, I don't have to stretch the language to cover, and I'm not making any argument about can't he go and buy it on the open market.
Okay.
I understand the point that Mr. Duda is making, but that's simply not necessary to reach in this case.
Okay, so here's my second question. What about the fact that under the study done by the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, about 25% of people who are getting these benefits are also getting benefits from some other source, including Medicare, spousal coverage, coverage for another job. What's the significance of that?
You know, I don't assign any particular significance to it, because I think in many of these cases, this is being done cooperatively by benign neglect. Let me put it that way. But I think, if you look at the case law, and Mr. Duda agrees with this, if you look at Pyle, Berry, and McCaffrey, it's very clear that once somebody becomes Medicare eligible, not taking it, but once they hit the age of 65 and become Medicare eligible, then PSEBA benefits can be reduced to zero. So if we are to assume that people are covered by Medicare and also receiving PSEBA benefits, the only conclusion I can come to is that municipalities are voluntarily continuing to provide coverage, or that they're unaware that they could reduce coverage at that time by saying you have to take Medicare and you are no longer eligible for the benefit. Because, I mean, those three cases couldn't be more clear, specific McCaffrey case says, goes so far as to say that a claimant who didn't want to take Medicare, that claimant had said, no thanks, I'm not going to avail myself of this benefit, said she had to.
Right.
So,
and this is my last question. You had suggested that the recent amendments to section 10A that said you were entitled to any plan was a response to Pyle, but is there something specific in the legislative history that suggests that it's a response to Pyle? Because there's a lengthy gap between those two things. I'm just wondering what your, why you think that's a response to Pyle.
I don't think there's anything in the legislative history that specifically suggests that it's a direct response to an appellate case. I'm just saying that the reason you would make an amendment saying you have to not just offer the basic plan is because there was appellate case law in the state saying all you have to offer is the basic plan. So that's the contradiction. They're making an amendment saying you have to offer them all of the available plan, any plan that's available to your other employees, not just the basic plan. That was the amendment. And that's in a direct contradiction to the appellate case law that said all you have to give is. I think it's the Peoria case. I can provide that. I can provide that specific site. Certainly by the end of this argument.
Okay.
When I have a minute, but
I'll shut up. Yeah. I'm sorry. Let me continue.
Okay. Well, so let me just make the point, and Mr. Duda also kind of made the point earlier. So I don't have to go into it with too much detail, but there is just a challenge, and it's outlined in the McCaffrey case about what, how to calculate a municipality set off amount and whether the appellate court can reach that. But I also just want to point out that the administrative posture of this case is that the hearing officer reduced the benefit to zero. So the question is whether he was erroneous in adopting the position of those cases, the direction of those cases, and saying that there was no premium to pay. And in this case, the availability of the secondary coverage is, you know, virtually identical to the plans that would have been available under the village's coverage, but that's not necessarily the case. And I think the court would have to engage in an evaluation of what is the quality of the coverage? What is the deductible? Does the deductible have any kind of cash value? And simply put, 10-1A does not say the employee is entitled to whatever the cash value of the basic plan coverage is, and then they can make their choices as they wish. And I think that's what Mr. Duda is asking this court to read into the statute, is that there is some kind of cash value to the benefit, and that that can just be set off against whatever the cash is, the cost is of the alternate coverage. And that's just simply far beyond the confines of the language of the statute.
Counsel, I thought that Mr. Mertz was asking for reimbursement for the monies that he had paid on his wife's policy. So that's a finite value.
He's also asking for the decision that the village's obligation now and into the future be zero to be reversed, so that the village has a continuing contribution obligation to the wife, to Ms. Mertz's premium, out-of-pocket premium payments.
He's asking to reverse the decision and to be made whole, and whole in his mind would be to have provided the coverage of the employee insurance and whatever coverage it provided for his wife, who actually had her own policy, and their children, as per that employee relationship, employer-employer relationship at the time that he was declared to be.
Catastrophically injured. I mean, we would concede that. We concede that under 10-1-8, he's catastrophically injured. So he's also asking.
necessarily, but you don't concede that he's entitled to payment because you don't believe that. Anyway, that's the next case, but go
correct.
Ahead.
Yeah, no, correct. We're jumping a little bit ahead to the next portion. But yes, he's asking for a calculation of a set-off amount. And the hearing officer concluded that he just had no ability to do that. And the availability of the secondary source coverage, the benefits available from another source, reduced Mount Prospect's obligation effectively to zero cash value, because their obligation is to provide the coverage if there is not other coverage available.
Doesn't that create an incentive for municipality just to blanket deny any coverage across the board? See if these folks go out on their own, go on their spouse's policy, which is what happened here as a result of that. Purpose of this statute?
Well, I think that the purpose of the PSEBA statute is to ensure that public servants who are injured in emergency situations have adequate health insurance coverage for life. I agree with Mr. Duda that's ultimately the purpose of this statute. But the village's obligation extends to ensuring that the claimant has that coverage, and he does under his wife's plan. But there would be no 101A, the limitation section, that just wouldn't exist if the idea was we don't want the we want to just guarantee this and guarantee that there's no conflict by just saying you have to keep them on. Instead, there is a limitation. There is a section 101A, and it says, however, your benefit is reduced by benefits payable from another source. And that language does create sort of a little bit of an adversarial posture, because the village absolutely has a responsibility significant financial burden. I'm not going to hide that. And the village has a responsibility to its taxpaying constituents to make sure that it doesn't just write a blank check for people who have appropriate and adequate coverage available and payable from other sources. So if there aren't any other questions, I just want to conclude by sort of framing the argument. PSEBA requires, and the case law interpreting PSEBA are clear, that where there is secondary source coverage available, where there are benefits available from another source, that the potential PSEBA claimant or recipient has a responsibility to avail himself of those benefits, an obligation to avail himself of those benefits, if that's possible. And in this case, it is. So the hearing officer correctly determined, and the circuit court correctly affirmed the hearing officer, when they determined that the availability of an alternate full coverage group plan effectively reduces the financial contribution of Mount Prospect to zero for the time being, unless circumstances change. Thank you.
And considering the question that I believe Judge Wilson asked in the circuit court, what happens when circumstances change? Does he then return to the village and have them pick up the coverage?
Yes, I think, well, so again, this is assuming that none of the other findings of the hearing officer are disturbed throughout this change, and his wife was laid off. I think he would return to the village and say, I have been determined eligible for PSEBA coverage. I no longer have coverage available from a secondary source. I need the village's cover to pay my coverage. The village would be obligated to pay the coverage until he turned 65. And then once again, he would drop off because he would be Medicare eligible. And I just want to conclude also, especially for Justice Mikva, by giving you the site of the case on the basic coverage. It's Esser versus City of Peoria, 2019, Ill App 3rd, 180702. So it's the Esser case, which is cited in our. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Strassi. Mr. Duda, you've got a few minutes in rebuttal.
I was searching through all my papers because I knew that the defendant had cited that case, and I couldn't for the life of me remember the name of the plaintiff in that Peoria case. My rebuttal is quite short. The way counsel recited the language of 10A and said if there are benefits payable from another source, it shall reduce the municipality's obligation. I think those words establish the erroneous conclusion of the hearing officer, because payable from another source, the word another source means a source other than the catastrophically injured firefighter. Okay. The payable from the pocketbook of the catastrophically injured firefighter is not the another source contemplated 10A1. That's exactly what happened here. And I can't emphasize.
Any other source would be any source other than the municipality.
I don't agree. I think the payable from another source. Well, no, I understand that. I don't have any further rebuttal. I think the issue is been clarified through the discussion.
Okay, thank you for your excellent arguments. And now on to the other case. Twenty minutes aside and 5 minutes rebuttal, but you don't need to use all your time. And with that, we'll get started.
Thank you, and may it please the court. And I will do my best to be concise here because I know we're dealing with a secondary argument. But I also want to just frame the argument in this way, that this actually so we're kind of going back in time, even though it's a second in time argument. So we're now looking at 10B of PSEBA, which states that in relevant part, that in order for the firefighter, spouse, or dependent children to be eligible for insurance coverage under the Act, the injury or death must have occurred as the result of the firefighter's response to what is reasonably believed to be an emergency. So the village has argued that the hearing officer's order was incorrect when it determined that the as the result of a response to an emergency. But we're not just arguing a direct causation argument. So we're not asking this court to necessarily go back and re-examine the roots of each injury and determine whether the injuries were caused by a response or suffered in a response to an emergency. Because what I'll actually point to is an exhibit that was jointly filed by the claimant and respondent, so by Mertz and the village, in the circuit court's administrative review case. And that appears in the record in volume 2 of the record at CO3488. That is claimant's injury history. And so I'm going to refer to that because it was jointly submitted by the parties and it established each party's position as to the injuries that have been suffered by the claimant. And what the main thrust of our argument is throughout the record and throughout the case history, it's been established that somewhere between 17 and 21 different injuries were suffered by the claimant. OK, Okay. And those injuries were suffered over almost a 20-year period. And so the argument is that the injury history makes the claimant too attenuated to the response to the emergency to be considered for as in a response to emergency for the purposes of the
finding by the hearing officer. So just understand the posture of these cases. You want us to disregard or overrule the factual findings of the, we shouldn't defer to their factual findings of the hearing officer, and yet we should defer to the legal conclusions in the other case of the hearing officer.
So I would characterize this as a mixed question of law and fact. And I think actually, if you look at the Thompson versus submitted, that does a good job of laying out what the standard of review is for a case like this, because the village concedes, and it has conceded throughout the proceedings, that of that injury list, of that exhibit that I'm pointing you to, whether it's 17 or 21 injuries, that two of them were actually suffered in response to what could reasonably be believed to be an emergency. So we, if this court adopts the standard that is adopted in the Richter case and in some, you know, previous case law before this court, that just any element whatsoever, howsoever small, of a response to an emergency qualifies a claimant for PSEBA, then we concede under that interpretation that this claimant would be eligible for PSEBA. So what we're arguing is not that the facts should be different, because you know, we're not arguing there was never any emergency that contributed to the claimant's injury. And it's, we want you to go back and look at the facts and disturb the hearing officer's finding that there was an emergency response. We can see that two of the elements, at least two of the responses of the injuries that are listed were in response to emergencies. But what our argument is that when you're looking at an injury history like this, it's a cumulative injury history. So it doesn't fall under the definition of response to an emergency that's been expressed in the Pedersen and Gaffney cases. So this is a mixed question of law and fact.
Where's the legal question? Just to clarify for me, where's the legal question in that? What's the legal?
The legal question is the interpretation of response to an emergency. That's the legal question that's expressed in Gaffney. And so it's whether a cumulative injury can be suffered in response to an emergency.
So you want us to find that as a matter of law, the injury can't be cumulative? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that essentially, yes, that it can't be that cumulative, that you can't look at a 20-year employee health history and say that this can be reasonably interpreted as caused by a response to an emergency. Because, you know, what I will specifically say is there are several cases, appellate cases, which examine the idea of compound injuries. And, you know, as Mr. Druda had to concede in the first part of our argument, the village is playing a little bit of catch up here, right? Because essentially what these cases find is that if there's any part emergency as per the definition under PSEBA. But the cases that examine compound injuries, the Richter case, which I've cited, that's a 2011 second district case, that is where the employee in question sustained two injuries, one of which was an emergency injury and one of which was a non-emergency injury within 1 year. That case cited another case, the Barr versus Bartlett Fire Protection District case. In that case, there were three back injuries, two emergency and one non-emergency, suffered over the course of 3 years. And then the final case that talks about a compound injury is Phelan versus McHenry County Sheriff's Department. In that case, there were four total injuries, two of which were in response to an emergencies, and the time attenuation was 3 years. So where a court has looked at this, they are looking at, there's a couple of incidents close together in time, and there's an element of that that's emergency. Here, again, if you look at the record, and I'm only asking you to look at what plaintiff or the claimant himself has agreed to submit to the circuit court. Again, it's 21 separate incidents. Not even all of those 21 incidents occurred while on the job, much less in the response to an emergency. I mean,
so basically your position is twofold. Either cumulative injuries not should not be looked at, or if they should, this was too long a period with too many injuries, just misapplied the cumulative injury analysis.
Correct. Correct. And that's why you're getting a mixed question of law and fact. That's why our position is that it's a mixed question of law and fact. Because again, the hearing officer's order just found, hey, if I find, you know, at not even 1%, I mean, there's no standard. If I find any part of this was potentially suffered or due to an emergency response, then this claimant qualifies for a placebo. And that when you're talking about somebody who is, you know, a firefighter and who is engaged in a physical job, there's just never going to be somebody who, unless we have a finite incident, a direct causal link, there's always going to be somebody who says, okay, well, 10 years ago, this happened, you know, 8 years ago, this happened, 6 years ago, this happened. And on this kind of record, it's just too attenuated to award the placebo benefits. So that is the first part of our argument. The second part of our argument deals with the statutory construction of placebo as continuation coverage. And this part of the argument is examining the timing of the claimant's submission for placebo and when placebo benefits attach to the claimant. Again, we have a bit of an uphill argument here, and I'm not going to try to hide that fact, because we're working with the NOAC case.
Right.
Yeah. We're working with the NOAC case, and the NOAC case basically says that benefits attach on the date that the catastrophic injury is determined. However, I think if you look carefully at the NOAC case, you'll find that that case doesn't actually stretch to a situation like this. The biggest distinction is that in the NOAC case, there was no administrative procedure by the Village of Country Club Hills to have a determination of placebo benefits under 10B. So when a claimant becomes catastrophically injured, the first step is that they apply for and are determined to qualify for a line of duty disability pension under 10A. That establishes catastrophic injury. And as a matter of law, you know, the case law has settled on this point at least, which is refreshing in the placebo area that there's some element of settled case law. But the settled case law says that a catastrophic injury as a matter of law is determined by the line of duty disability pension. So when he's found eligible for that, it qualifies as catastrophic injury. But then there's a second element of a placebo analysis, which is, was the injury suffered in response to an emergency? So that's a separate proceeding and determination. And the village has the right to establish administrative procedures for finding that determination, making a finding on that determination. Now, in the NOAC case, the Village of Country Club Hills had no such administrative procedure. They did not undertake a 10B determination as to whether the injury was suffered in response to an emergency. They merely said, okay, well, if you're catastrophically injured as pursuant to a line of duty disability pension, then you are eligible to claim placebo benefits, and we're awarding the placebo benefits to you. So in the case where they examine when do those benefits attach, the benefits were attached on the determination date. But that's because there was no second determination date. There was no determination date of eligibility for placebo. So when a village does employ administrative procedures, when they avail themselves of the privilege to set administrative procedures and make a determination on eligibility of placebo, the attachment of placebo benefits should occur on the determination of eligibility for placebo benefits. And the claimant in this case left the village's health insurance and moved on to his wife's MetLife group coverage health insurance plan before he even applied for consideration of eligibility for PSEBA benefits. He had his line of duty disability pension award, and the village said, okay, well, we don't have any obligation to continue to pay your premiums anymore, which they wouldn't have, by the way. If he had never applied for PSEBA coverage, then they wouldn't have had an obligation to continue to pay his premiums. So the village was well within its rights to notify him, okay, you have to make a decision. What are you going to do about this? So he left the plan, and then he applied for a PSEBA determination. So the idea of awarding PSEBA benefits to somebody who had not already been on the health insurance to begin with at the time he even applied and who had abandoned the plan. I mean, that's Mr. Duda himself noted that in the Pyle case, Mr. Pyle continued to pay the premiums until he was awarded the reimbursement for that out-of-pocket cost. But here we have a claimant who abandoned the group coverage. And so, you know, that defies the idea of continuation coverage and having a benefit available when the benefit has not attached at the time that the claimant leaves the plan. That dovetails with interpretation of the Illinois Insurance Code, which provides that continuation of employer-sponsored coverage is the health insurance plan that the firefighter was enrolled in at the time that he became eligible for continuation coverage. Our firefighter was not, Mertz, the claimant, was not enrolled in any health insurance plan at the time that he became eligible for continuation coverage. So our argument is that because he abandoned the employer-sponsored plan and was not on a plan at the time of his application for PSEBA benefits, the court or the hearing officer cannot, in retrospect, award him the ability to reactivate the plan to avail himself of continuation benefits.
Just so I understand this. One, in those municipalities where there's no hearing, where it's just automatically given once you're determined to be catastrophically injured, and another timetable for those villages that or municipalities that decide that want to have a hearing.
Correct. That squares with the NOAC case. The NOAC case says that benefits attach on the date that eligibility is determined. But in that case, because there are no 10B procedures, eligibility is determined on the date that the claimant is found to qualify for a line of duty disability pension. So it's in other proceedings where there is a clear administrative procedure set by the municipality to apply for and then qualify for PSEBA coverage, it totally reads Section 10B out of existence if you don't defer to that administrative proceeding for the attachment of benefits at the determination of that eligibility. There's no reason to have that date be on the 10A determination and then even have subsequent proceedings if that's the one and only date. I mean, it just reads the 10B meaning out of existence. So I just want to conclude by saying, of course, the village, is trying to balance the interests of not only its employees and their rights and their benefits and making sure that its employees and former employees are taken care of, but it's trying to balance its responsibilities to its residents. The court with the idea that we're asking ultimately for additional guidance, and this is an area in which there's a lot of litigation and a lot of case law, and we're trying to make sure that we responsibly interpret and apply that to the balanced benefit of everyone involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kathy. Mr. Duda, you're on.
May it please the court, counsel. Up until this point, I've had a very pleasant relationship with my opponent, but I have to tell you, her phrase that my client abandoned his rights to placebo in his behavior and opted to take another insurance, A, has no legal significance, but factually is completely untrue. The village had been writing letters directly to Mr. Mertz, even though they knew I was his lawyer. Their human resources person is writing letters to him, telling him that his insurance was $100 in back premiums, and that he was going to be terminated. Beginning in September 13th of 2013, this is before the pension hearing, I wrote to them saying, we don't want those benefits. He's entitled to a continuation of his health insurance benefits based on his injury. That led to a whole series of correspondence, but the pension fund issued its written decision March 26, 2014. I wrote to the village and on April the 4th, asserting Mertz's claim to a placebo. That was the first time this from I there had been correspondence with the village since September 2013. The May letter in response to my that there was an application. Now, incidentally, I'm not sure the statute makes any mention of an application or makes your rights contingent on it, but be that as it may, Mr. Mertes filled out the application as soon as he received the application. The idea that he abandoned anything is just simply ludicrous, but that's of no legal consequence because there are two Supreme Court decisions that dispose of the employer's argument. Okay, counsel refers to Novak. I want to read word for word what Novak says. Okay, this is on 2011 Illinois 11111838 paragraph 29. For the reasons set forth above, we conclude that under Section 10A of PSEBA, an employer's obligation to pay the entire health insurance premium for an injured officer and his family attaches on the date that it is determined that the officer's injury is catastrophic. That is, on the date it is determined that the injured officer is permanently disabled and therefore eligible for a line of duty disability pension, right? There's no, that is the date, the relevant date, and that's March 18th, 2014. The effort to evade that clear holding that there were no rules and regulations, that somehow the village, by ordinance or by implementation of administrative procedures, can reverse that decision itself has been found but he's the right to prepare regulations regarding the procedures to be followed in determining whether someone is eligible for placebo. But the appellate court specifically said that right to write these rules and regulations is limited and they cannot be inconsistent with the statute as interpreted by the Supreme Court. All right. The Supreme Court in Novak has interpreted when the effective date of payment under PSEBA is made. Therefore, any rules or regulations that attempts to circumvent that is contrary to Peterson and contrary to the exact wording of Section 20 of the statute. And I don't need to rely on basic argument in the case of Local 50, Illinois International Association of Firefighters versus the City of Peoria. Peoria had implemented a series of, well, actually it was only two ordinances, and which substantially altered the interpretation of PSEBA made by Croy, Novak, and Gaffney. And they said that we're doing that under the assertion of our home rule authority, that under the Illinois Constitution, a home rule unit has the power to concurrently enact legislation along with the General Assembly. And the Supreme Court said, oh, no, you don't. When the Supreme Court gives an interpretation to a statute, that's the interpretation. You can't change it by local ordinance. So the argument that that Mount Prospect now has procedures and those procedures can change the effective date is simply contrary to the Local 50 International Association of Firefighters case. When we come to the primary issue as to whether or not the catastrophic injuries were the result of the performance of duties that the argument has no merit for two reasons. Okay. The first is that the issue of causation, in other words, what led to the disability that entitled Eric to line of duty disability benefits, that is incorporated in the pension in its decision. The 21 episodes that that Eric had engaged in where he injured his back, and that as a result of those, he became so disabled that he was entitled to a line of duty disability. That finding is part of the Helin doctrine. And the case I would cite, I would ask the court to, I cited it in my brief, Cronin versus, I think, the Village of Skokie, where the appellate court said, the pension board determines what caused the disability. It's only our job is to simply scrutinize whether or not any of these injuries were the result of responding to what they reasonably believed to be an emergency. I'm going to wrap it up pretty quickly, but I have to argue the second district's definition of clearly erroneous. Clearly erroneous is probably the standard of review for this issue. And the second district was emphatic that clearly erroneous was a highly deferential standard. And it's not enough to just feel that the standard is that you come away with the belief that a mistake has been made. And the appellate court held, it's not just that you feel there's a mistake, you have to feel the mistake as if you're in the presence of an unrefrigerated fish that had been out for more than 5 months. So I don't think the hearing officer's decision reaches that standard put forth by the second district. But if the court wants to go into any detail with the episodes that led to the disability, I would point out two things. First, the hearing officer not only listed each individual event and gave some degree of detail as to how they constituted an emergency, he actually analyzed the pension board examining physicians who gave an opinion. There were two opinions that I think the hearing officer was impressed by. One was Dr. Stamoulos, who said that the disability was the result of the cumulative effects of a number of these sequential back injuries, but that the quote, the straw that broke the camel's back was the episode of May 5, 2011. All right. And he relied, the hearing officer relied on that opinion. Frank Phillips gave an opinion because the village had been, or the pension board was concerned whether the auto accident in April of 2012 might have contributed to the disability. And Frank Phillips found that it had nothing to do whatsoever. The auto accident did nothing to advance the disability. But if you look at the May 5th episode, this was an emergency. The defendant admits an emergency because we have an unconscious victim who's not breathing, who has a stroke, and there's a limited period of time to get him to the hospital so that he doesn't die. Eric is on the foot part of the fire department cot, and they're rolling down the stairs to get to the ambulance, and the front the wheel comes off of the curb, and the patient's about to fall out of the force to prevent that, and he re-injures his back. With this injury, within a week, he's referred to an orthopedic surgeon, all right, Stanford Tack. Dr. Tack, within another week, recommends a double fusion of the low back, and that was performed on July 7th, 2011. Eric returns to work after almost a year off of work. He does return to work. But after he returns to work, the fusion is a non-union event, which happens in a certain percentage of surgeries. And it's the non-union of that fusion and that led to his getting a line of, or needing a line of duty disability. The idea that there's no, that the causation is attenuated, it doesn't make sense. The hearing officer relied on this sequence, which clearly temporally and with medical support indicates that the May 5th, 2011 injury is the straw that broke the camel's back. And therefore the hearing officer's finding was not clearly erroneous. It was completely supported by the evidence. So I would suggest that the complaint of the defendant village of Mount Prospect be denied any relief of any kind whatsoever. Thank you very much for your attention again.
Okay, Ms. Spratsky, final word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just make a brief point on rebuttal, and I will also compliment Mr. Duda and say, yes, the parties have worked together very cooperatively during this process, and I don't mean any disparagement of out that the Pedersen case, Pedersen, which allows for the creation of administrative procedures by home rule units to administer placebo, there is not a limitation on that, on the attachment of the benefits, either in the statute or the case law. I'm arguing that NOAC does not limit the administrative procedure. Who only have a 10-day attachment date. So establishing a procedure, an administrative procedure under 10B for a placebo determination would not conflict with that. Neither would it conflict with the statute, which does not provide a clear attachment date for placebo benefits. So that it's simply not the conflict that Mr. Duda says it is, although he's completely correct. Statute by the creation of their own administrative procedures. I fully agree with that. But that's not what we're arguing has been done in this case. And then, you know, in terms of the cumulative nature of the injury, I think the fact that Mr. Duda himself is using the words straw that broke the camel's back, it is just an indication of how much had accumulated over the course of the years, and the nature of this, you know, truly is The PSEBA statute is limited. I mean, we wish that every public servant or public employee was granted this kind of benefit and had this kind of lifetime security, but that's not the case. The PSEBA statute indicates that it's only for extraordinary. Whether a public servant qualifies to receive the benefit. So the benefit is not, you know, just something that's handed out without examination of whether it's truly a case in which those benefits have been justified. And our argument is that it's simply not. And so the hearing officer's order should be overturned. Thank you.
May I make an oral motion for a one sentence sir rebuttal?
One sentence.
Eric Murdy's had to file a declaratory judgment lawsuit to get hearing before the village. Period.
Yes, it's in the briefs. Okay. Well, I want to thank counsel for wonderful arguments this morning and for your superb briefing. You've given us a lot to think about. The matter will be taken under advisement for further study. An opinion, but no matter how the case turns out, your respective clients can take comfort in knowing that they've been very capably represented by your excellent advocacy, and we thank you for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.